Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on August 20th, 2019. This is class 1 of 32 of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into anicca, anatta, and dukkha. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight we're going to start our 16-week, 32-class study of Vipassana, which means, in the context of the Buddha's Dhamma, Vipassana means introspective insight, and a very specific introspective insight into something called the three marks of existence. I know you don't understand that yet, but does everybody understand what I've just said?
Mm-hmm.
And Joe, that's what upcoming course is about, to develop that understanding, but just to keep it in the right context. And so this is the essence of the Buddhist teaching, and it coalesces on anatta, and it coalesces on a true understanding of self. The Buddha described a human being as being made up of six properties in the Dhatuvabhanga Sutta. You remember this. And nothing else. We're made up of the four elements: earth, wind, fire, water, the space element, and the thinking element, or the consciousness element. That describes every human being. That's common to every human being. Anything that is attached to that through a fabricated view then starts creating a fabricated reality, a fabricated view of self. Is that without you? I know you probably don't get that yet, Joe, but is that clear to everyone else?
Mm-hmm.
And so the entire Buddha's Dhamma is geared to pierce that veil of ignorance rooted in fabricated constructions of self, and recognize that we made these views of self out of whole cloth. There's nothing of substance to what we attached ourselves to and are using to define ourselves in the world. And so that creates a lot of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing stress and suffering. Rooted in the description of dukkha is unsatisfactoriness because of a lack of understanding of self. So again, everything the Buddha taught was taught to gain this understanding. As we have started attaching ourselves to these different objects, impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas, and begin to describe ourselves to ourselves in relation to the world around us and other people, we get deeper and deeper involved in this fabrication. And so we get to the point where we think that life is about the things that I have and the things that I have to get in order to maintain my happiness. And what happens then? The things that we think we have now have us. We're controlled by our fabricated view because we've decided that we need these things. But these things that we decide we need to live in the world and to be established in the world are fabricated. It doesn't mean that the house that I live in, the physical structure, is fabricated. But my belief that I need that house to be happy is a fabricated belief. And in that case, the house has me. I don't have the house anymore. So immediately our minds might be going, well, how do I own a house, or how do I live in a house? How do you? How do you live in a house free of any clinging attachment? Anybody want to answer?
This is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am.
Yeah. Oh,
you can live in the biggest mansion or the smallest hovel in the world. And they're both fine shelter, aren't they? And as long as you don't have to have it, it won't have you.
Self-identification.
Yep, and that last line kind of is another essence of the Dhamma. We don't want to be imprisoned by our own thoughts, by attaching ourselves to objects, events, views, and ideas that are not us. And yet we do it all the time. That's the brilliant breakthrough that the Buddha described in the Nagara Sutta. So I don't want to get, I'm conscious of how long this is. I'm going to read this in two parts. Saturday will be the second part. And at least to something else just about the structure of this class. Often when I'm teaching a subject, that I'll teach it to the Tuesday class and the Saturday class. I won't do that this time for a few reasons. One is just practicality. We'd end up in the middle of next summer rather than the end of this year. with this study. I think it's just, it breaks it up too much. The other is that I know that none of you can likely attend, except Lorna and Ram, maybe Matt, every single class. But I encourage you to come to as many classes as you can, and the classes that you can't make, if just to try to make up, you know, watch the recording or listen to the recording when you can, because I think this is going to be a remarkable class. I hope you all find it that way. But as I put it together and as we get through it, how many of you have looked at the schedule and the suttas that are included? It's a lot, isn't it?
Scary.
Well, I don't think it, you'll find, or at least I expect, all of us, even myself, to have developed a very profound understanding of the heart of the matter. What am I? What is this world that I live in? So let's get to it. I'm gonna read. Come on. I'm gonna read the first half of this, and I'm gonna attempt to do it without too much commentary, but you know how that often goes. Why is this doing this?
It's really an Etch-a-Sketch, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't get into portrait mode. There it goes. Wow. Give me a minute to... Well, I can do it like this.
And didn't we call it a sutta-palooza?
Yeah.
Retreat?
Yeah. Let me just see if I can get this out of... Keeps doing that. Okay, I'm going to leave it alone. But if you have any questions, or if I say something that's confusing, just please let me know. Okay? I can hardly see anyway. Vipassana starts with a line that I think most of you know. All conditioned things that arise will pass away. That points directly to fabricated conditioned views that are simply rooted in impermanence. The quote above describes the purpose and focus of Vipassana in the context intended by an awakened human being. Upon hearing the Buddha's very first discourse, Venerable Khandana spoke these words. The Buddha responded, "You are now Anakandana, the one who understands," meaning he has awakened. Vipassana means insight. In the context of the Buddha's Dhamma, Vipassana is not merely a popular hybrid meditation method or a distracting grasping after insight into all impermanent phenomena practice. In the context of the Buddha's Dhamma, Vipassana describes introspective insight into a fabricated misunderstanding of self in relation to the world. When you look up Vipassana in a Pali dictionary, Pali to English dictionary, that's the description of it. It's not just insight. It is specifically introspective insight, which means the insight we're looking for is within ourselves, which is a clear direction that the insight we're looking for is within our thoughts, because that's what's within ourselves, isn't it? So the point is that this idea of gaining insight into all things that are arising and passing away, or fabricated scenarios looking for insight, is simply a distraction away from where we're looking. We're looking outside of ourselves. And that type of Vipassana, it's a little bit subtle to see, is attempting to analyze an external fabricated view that we've established. And if every time we do that, we're out of our body and we're into a fabrication. No matter how deep we go, no matter how valuable we think the insight is in there, it has to be a fabricated understanding because of where we're looking. You can't find understanding where no understanding is available. These two components of ignorance of self in relation to the world, in relation to all impermanent phenomena, results in dukkha. Those are the three marks of existence. That's the whole focus of introspective insight in the Buddha's Dhamma. It is ignorance of self in relation to the world resulting in stress and suffering that are the three common characteristics of all human beings. These three common characteristics are often referred to as three marks of existence.
Can you say what they are?
Yes. It's right here. The Pali Sanskrit words that describe these three marks are anicca, which means all impermanent phenomena, and it's usually referred to in the more mystical applications of the cosmos. But of course, we can't, and that's just that's that translation interpretation is rooted in mythology, and a more clear understanding. The Buddha wasn't concerned about our relationship to the phenomena of Pluto, because we can't have an interaction with Pluto, can we? We can look at it through a telescope, but there's no relationship with it other than that. In describing the cosmos in the Dhamma, a better word and a much simpler word is simply the world, because that's where we find ourselves. We don't find ourselves in the universe, do we? We think about it, we might speculate about what it's like, but we're in the world. And so that's it, the insight is found within that.
And the world, the part of the world that affects us directly.
Oh, yes.
We're not necessarily looking at, the world in Tibet.
Oh, yeah. And again, thank you. The idea of the world as our focus then helps us narrow it down to our world. In other words, what's occurring in Tibet really has no effect on me, does it? My world is what I'm thinking about, what I'm considering, what I'm attached to. That's the world we're looking at. And again, the reason why this is important is we can get lost in the idea of the things that are going on in the world. Well, there's a lot of things always going on in the world. There always has been and there always will be. Some good, some bad, some violent, some pleasant. That's all part of living in the world. And the idea of the Dhamma is to depersonalize and create dispassion for all of that. To realize, how do we depersonalize that, our experience in the world? To understand that we are simply six properties. And as a human being composed of six properties, I'm now free to do anything and have any experience I want, and in practical terms, pay for it. That's a human life. So then the question gets down to how am I going to live this life? Am I going to live this life in as meaningful and peaceful way as I can? And if the answer is yes, here's a way to do it. And if the answer is that sounds a little bit too crazy for me, I want to get a bigger pile of gold, that's fine too. Or practice something different, using maybe somewhat silly examples, to say this is the way to understand this process. So the first mark of existence is all impermanent phenomena, and in a simple terms, the world. Number two is anatta, the Pali word. And that simply means, let me qualify that a little bit. Anatta, the way it's been translated and interpreted, particularly in certain Mahayana schools, but really in general, is that the word anatta means no self. And so whole dharmas have grown up around trying to find a resolution, a reconciliation for that one misapplied term. And the conclusion, the resolution is, awakening means understanding that the self is nothing. We live in this grand, vast expanse of emptiness and nothingness, which becomes necessary when you start from that wrong premise that the Buddha taught that there's no such thing as a self. He didn't. He used a common term of his time, anatta, which really meant in the old Pali / Hindu interpretation, simply that we are not atta, we're not the grand, again, greatly simplifying it, atta means the grand Brahma, the grand creator or governor of the universe, if you will. I mean, this is all through Hindu mythology. The Buddha used that term because it was common during his time. It's something that he studied and rejected. And just like he used the word karma and rebirth in a very different way than was common, he used the word anatta. But it was a brilliant way, isn't it? Because he was directly using a central term that people were confused about and that they were familiar with. So we said, guess what? Your view of anatta is a wrong view. This is what it means, and this is what it means. Anatta are fabricated views of self in relation to impermanent phenomena or the world, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truth. Put simply, the views we're holding of ourselves are wrong views. The Buddha is saying, let go of the views. Excuse me.
So did he change it from no self?
Yes, and so did I. Yeah, I mean, he was saying those beliefs, and they were common. You remember the Buddha's what's a sutta? I can't think of it now. Aditya Pariyaya Sutta, where the Buddha teaches and describes his whole awakening process and studying with the foremost teachers of his time, who taught ultimately in different terms, but ultimately they culminate in an experience of nothingness, a speculated realm of nothingness or emptiness that everybody believed. I mean, that was a common culmination to all religions at the time. And if you look closely at modern religions, almost every one of them resolves itself in some type of speculated non-physical existence, such as heaven, or in the Buddha's terms, it might be Amitabha Buddha, or Tulsita heaven, these other terms that we use. The Buddha didn't teach any of that. The Buddha taught, and he didn't say there's no such thing as these other realms of existence. He simply said it's unskillful to even consider them because we can't experience it. We can't know it. What we can do is have a meaningful human life moment by moment as life occurs. But didn't anybody have a comment? Okay. And I can't really see, so if you got something, holler. And the third mark is dukkha, or ongoing confusion, delusion, and distracting and disappointing and unsatisfactory life experience. A subtle ongoing disappointment. That's dukkha. And so even that last statement, a subtle ongoing disappointment, well, why should I bother? Why should I come here on Tuesday night to deal with subtle ongoing disappointment? Because it's the subtle ongoing disappointments that create ongoing distraction and stress and suffering in our minds. It's the ongoing struggle with not wanting to be disappointed in this moment that forces our mind out of our body and into a speculated realm. Even if it is, I'm having a tough day, that glass of scotch is going to be great tonight. And for those of you that can actually have a glass of scotch at night, that's not me, you're now out of your body, aren't you? And you're in that glass of scotch, or a piece of chocolate cake, or a round of golf, or kicking the dog, or shooting up a neighborhood. I mean, those are all the results of ignorance, aren't they? Rather than recognizing, in this moment, I am disappointed. Lorna got it. What do I need to do about it? Nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
It's not me.
Well, I think understanding in that moment is what you need to do about it.
Yes, understand that this is something that is impermanent. If I am disappointed, it's because I want what's occurring to be different than it is, which is a fabricated thought, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Do you see, and again, this will become much more clear as we go along, and I'm trying to paint a broad picture, but drilling it down to this is what we're looking for. And so as we continue with this Dhamma study, and we'll then be looking at specific suttas. Many of them we've looked at before. I think I've written five new translations of suttas or interpretations. But we're going to be looking at suttas that we've gone over again and again, but with a specific focus on how does this relate to the three marks of existence and gaining that insight. And I think you'll find it very useful.
John, you asked what you can do about it. You can return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing is what you can do about
it. That's it. And when you've established that through jhana meditation, when you do that, you bring your mind right back into your body, into this moment. And all of you have experienced that, haven't you? I'm sorry, Joe, I don't mean to exclude you. You're just starting. Is that true? That even if it's just for a moment in a stressful or a time when you find yourself out of your body, it works, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And for most of us, it might not last for all that long, but now we have the tool. To reclaim, literally reclaim our minds.
It's part of the understanding is knowledge with regard to stress.
Yeah.
You know, and grasping after something in that moment is direct knowledge. And that's the experience also in that same moment through understanding the release and coming back to the breath.
Yes, and it's just that way. When you, and I'll talk about this when we get to it, but the Four Noble Truths, when you just read them out, they describe the three marks of existence. And I just want to put that out there. I'll teach it in a couple of weeks. So those are the three marks of existence: anicca, anatta, dukkha, impermanence, a misunderstanding of self, and the suffering that results from that clinging relationship between wrong views of self and the world. That's the three marks. The reason why I'm saying that is when I first started looking at this thing called the three marks, there was really no reference, and I wasn't studying the suttas. I wasn't even really aware that there were such thing as actual teachings of the Buddha still preserved. The explanations of these were also clouded in and myth and esoterica and magic that had no relation to these three simple things. And again, the reason why I'm emphasizing it, this describes a human condition, doesn't it? Dukkha originates in and is dependent on specific ignorance of Four Noble Truths. This is the profound knowledge that the Buddha awakened to as described in the Paticca-Samuppada Sutta, the primary sutta on dependent origination that we're going to get to in the first couple of weeks. In order to develop useful vipassana, an authentic understanding of dependent origination is required. This fundamental relationship is explained in detail further on. What Kandana was describing with that quote, all conditioned things that arise will pass away, are subject to passing away. What Kandana is describing to his teacher, the Buddha, is his development of profound vipassana. Now, Kandana was practicing in the same environment that the Buddha was and many of the same teachers. So he was acquiring the same knowledge of what they were looking for and what they weren't looking for. And Kandana was at that point where all he needed to do was hear a clear presentation of what the Dhamma was, and all of that ignorance fell away from him. But it wasn't something miraculous. It was simply the result of his own right effort that culminated at that point. Kandana developed insight into his conditioned views of himself rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Conditioned by ignorance, these self-referential views condition life experience that then obscures reality while providing seeming validity to a fabricated view of himself in relation to the world he lived in. Rooted in ignorance of a self entangled in the world, Kandana created distracting self-referential views that brought him confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing discontent and disappointment. That's what happens to all of us. Upon hearing the words of his teacher, Kandana was able to recognize that the cause of his own confusion and discontent arose not from any external force, meaning he was being punished by some creator god or a grand psycho-spiritual field of behavior modification that's acting on him, which is really what most of those beliefs look like. Not from any external force, but lack of ritualistic practice or past misdeeds. Kandana recognized that it was his own fabricated views of himself in relation to the world he lived in as the cause of his stress and suffering. And that relates directly to, and we'll talk more about this later, but just to make the point now, what I just read relates directly to karma and rebirth. So most people see karma as part of this grand psycho-spiritual universal non-physical system that's acting on us to make us pay for our misdeeds, or at least make us aware of our misdeeds, and that if we don't change our ways, we're going to give birth to infinite future lives of suffering in the realms of hungry ghosts, in the realms of different deprivation, and all the things that are part of mystical Buddhism. The Buddha simply used those metaphorical terms to describe a troubled quality of mind. And the point of the Dhamma, again, gaining this insight, is that so we don't give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. It has nothing to do with a physical, a future rebirth or anything like that. Is that clear? So again, it brings us, the point of that type of understanding is it then brings us back to the immediacy of the Dhamma. It occurs in this moment. There's no Dhamma in the past. There's no Dhamma in the future. We can't prepare ourselves for a future Dhamma. What we can do is cultivate the field of our own understanding. And that can only occur in the present moment. Remember the Loka or the Bhava Sutta? Karma is the field, consciousness is the seed, and craving is the moisture. A field grows in the moment. You know, even if we don't notice it, corn is growing every moment, isn't it? The same as we are. And so what are we going to grow into? What are we going to evolve into? Are we going to evolve into an awakened human being, grow into that, or are we going to continue ignorance? Okay. I think I know the answer in this room. Kandana's own ignorance of Four Noble Truths was also the cause of his previous self-perpetuating and distracting grasping after salvation Dhamma practice. I should call that Dharma practice. This well-focused introspective insight distinguished the Buddha's Dhamma from other Dharmas of his time. I usually make that distinction. That when I'm talking about the Dhamma, I'm talking about the Buddha's teachings as preserved in the Sutta Pitaka. When I talk about Dharma, I'm simply referring to everything else that has developed since the Buddha's passing.
or before.
Yeah, or before her, yes. Yeah, those teachers of the teachings of Alara Kalama and Udeka Ramaputta are Dharma teachings, not Dhamma teachings. This necessary clear distinction continues today. This next section is called Understanding Useful and Skillful Vipassana. The compulsive manner that dependent origination has been adapted, accommodated, embellished, or outright dismissed by most of modern Buddhism is perhaps the best example of the corruption that follows from ignoring a Buddha's authentic Dhamma. And again, the only reason I'm pointing that out is to point out, in this context, the corruption of doing just that, of ignoring the Buddha's Dhamma. And all of that, from years and years of doing this, I can clearly trace that back to a misunderstanding, a misapplication, or a complete embellishment of the Buddha's teaching of dependent origination. Mm-hmm. It requires continued ignorance of this key sutta in order to create these other dharmas that are out there. And again, I'm not saying they're good, bad, or indifferent, but they're different because they don't follow what the Buddha awakened to in dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. That's why you always hear me say, in order to understand anything in the Dhamma, you have to understand dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. These modern dharmas lack the framework and guidance for developing useful and skillful introspective insight into the clinging relationship between anicca, anatta, and dukkha. And I'm not just making that statement. It comes from my own experience and now many, many years of teaching. For at least 20 years, I was studying in all the major schools of Buddhism, and very serious study, and some of the most literally world-famous teachers. And if I take all those years and say that's 100% of my training, maybe a half of 1% was Four Noble Truths or Eightfold Path mentioned. Mm-hmm. I never heard dependent origination explained in any way that's close to what the Buddha's taught. And even when Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path were mentioned, they were mentioned as abstractions, not as a direct practice. And again, not putting it down, that the Buddha taught exactly the opposite, an Eightfold Path. Ignoring the Buddha's Dhamma in favor of adapted, accommodated, and or embellished dharmas is the nature of ignorance. A mind rooted in ignorance will create subtle, powerful, and elaborate strategies to continue to ignore ignorance. For ignorance to continue, ignorance must be ignored. Read it again. For ignorance to continue, ignorance must be ignored. So we want to be very careful that what we're developing, we want to be very careful that what we're putting our time and our right effort into is designed to recognize and abandon ignorance. Because if it isn't, it'll only serve to ignore our own ignorance. Is that clear?
Is that where rites and rituals will get you off the
always
goal of abandoning ignorance?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why the Buddha often said that this is not about rites and rituals. Those are distractions. And anything that might fall into that, such as ritualistic bowing, ritualistic chanting, even ritualistic, holding in mind visions, which is a type of ritual. I hold in mind Amitabha Buddha or Avalokiteshvara, and that's as my worshipful guru. That's all part of that. And anytime we do that, we're engaging in a practice that is fine to do. I'd rather see somebody engaging in chanting than shooting up a Philadelphia neighborhood, as an example. It's just to understand that it's just a distraction away from ignorance. It's a practice that allows us to ignore our own ignorance. And the only problem that I have with that, and the reason why I keep coming back to it, is, and it's the same problem the Buddha had, is reminding people that even though you call something doesn't make it that. Meaning, you can call something Buddhism, unless it's rooted in the Buddha's teachings, it's not. At least it's a different teaching, just like the word vipassana that we're focused on now. You can apply the word in any different way you want. The Buddha used it in the way that we're learning here today.
When you say ignoring ignorance, can we also say validating our ignorance?
Oh, sure, and we do it all the time.
Yeah.
We create specific scenarios that will validate our ignorance. And it's so subtle we don't understand it. Another clear way of saying that is, and I know every one of us has felt it before we became Buddha saints, when you feel angry, especially before you came to Dharma practice, when you feel angry, you justify that anger, don't you? Mm-hmm. At least to a certain extent. That's continuing to ignore the ignorance that you're feeling in your body, the pain of your own anger. And we start blaming other people, or blaming the world, or blaming this and that politician, or whatever
we're
it is. We're taking it personally.
Not only that, we are picking up that second arrow and injecting it in ourselves.
Exactly. It's a lot to suit that's coming up.
We love that.
That's the essence. Again, this isn't hard to see or hard to understand because we do it. The only reason it's difficult is because it's so close to us. Our own ignorance obscures our ignorance. That's why the Buddha taught an eightfold path. It wasn't just enough to say, guess what, folks? It's your ignorance of Four Noble Truths that's caused all the problem. Okay, we're good to go. He understood that that would be cruel to just leave it there, because a mind rooted in ignorance will continually fabricate even something as brilliant as a Buddha's teaching to ignore their own ignorance. That's why he gave so many different suttas and so many different scenarios in so many different words, all pointing to gaining this specific insight that we're going to develop over the next couple weeks. For ignorance to continue, ignorance must be ignored. It's included in the word ignorance, isn't it? But it is an aspect of ignorance. It's always grasping after further ignorance. I was almost going to talk, maybe I will later on. I read something by Einstein once that was brilliant in relation to this, but if I say it, I'm going to get off track, so I'm going to bring it up later. For ignorance to continue, ignorance must be ignored. Realizing this, the Buddha taught an eightfold path to recognize, interrupt, and abandon ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's all the direction we need to know what we should do in Dharma practice, an eightfold path. Ignoring or altering an awakened human being's Dhamma can only continue ignorance. The Eightfold Path provides the ongoing framework and guidance to recognize and interrupt ignored ignorance and develop useful and skillful introspective insight, vipassana, into the true nature of the relationship of individual human life, craving for and clinging to self-identification with impermanent and insubstantial phenomena. Excuse me for the long sentence, but everybody followed that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It is the nature of a mind ignorant of Four Noble Truths to become confused and distracted by continually craving for and clinging to impermanent phenomena arising and passing away. This certainly includes continually adapting, accommodating, and embellishing Buddhism to fit ever-changing views of what Buddhism should be in relation to impermanent worldly events. And that is an incredibly compulsive factor of modern Buddhism. In fact, many people talk about this emerging Western Buddhism and how we should adapt it. I won't mention his name because it'll sound like I'm putting him down. But there's a very, very famous teacher who's now teaching specifically that. The Buddha's Dhamma is no longer relevant. We should discard it and we should look at it in a completely new way. Okay. But there is nothing of the Buddha's Dhamma left. And that really is unfortunate. It would be, and I actually wrote this gentleman a letter because we had a past court. His earlier books had a lot to do with giving me license to look at Buddhism different than what it was presented. But this gentleman has gone this far. And I just sent him away saying, please recharacterize this as something that has nothing to do with the Buddha's Dhamma, because that's honest. That's all. Let people understand this for themselves, but that's not going to happen. A confused and distracted mind, craving for and clinging to self-identification with impermanent phenomena, is the essence of discontent, isn't it? If you're clinging onto something that is fleeting, it has to cause stress in your life. A confused self, craving for and clinging to impermanent phenomena, will always manifest as ongoing distraction and unsatisfactory experiences, which can only encourage continued craving and clinging and continued dukkha. It is this specific and well-focused introspective insight that formed the foundation for Siddhartha Gautama's awakening. It is this specific and well-focused introspective insight that is the purpose of the Eightfold Path. This is the next section, is Siddhartha Gautama develops useful and skillful insight, vipassana. It is a specific and well-focused introspective insight into anicca, anatta, and dukkha that form the foundation for Siddhartha Gautama's awakening. The auspicious development of a human being's useful and skillful insight into these three marks of existence occurred approximately 2,600 years ago. Siddhartha Gautama was born in an area of what is now southern Nepal on the border of northern India. Siddhartha left a family life of comfort, luxury, and power at the age of 29, seeking understanding of himself and the stress and suffering of the world. I know you've heard me say this over and over again, but again, just listen to it again. We heard last Saturday how important repetition is to the Dhamma. Look at it in the context now of this gaining insight into the three marks of existence. Over the course of 6 years, he methodically studied and rejected the common ascetic practices and the common philosophical, religious, and spiritual systems and beliefs of his time. He mastered the most advanced meditation practices and rejected them as well. Frustrated and disappointed by 6 years of searching outside of himself and the speculative, magical, mystical, and esoteric philosophies he encountered, Siddhartha left behind the distracting but comfortably familiar common dharmas and personal associations he developed during his search, including that very well-formed relationships with his five friends. The point I'm trying to make is he had to disassociate himself from everything that he was attached to prior to his awakening, including those that he associated with in his so-called spiritual practice. It was significant. Siddhartha now directed his mindfulness away from abstract philosophies and abstract external salvation strategies and placed his mindfulness solely within himself. You remember the Nagara Sutta. This courageous and profound decision liberated Siddhartha from continuing unskillful and distracting associations and distracting and confusing dharmas. This wise discrimination between what is skillful dharma practice and the ineffective, confusing, and distracting dharmas form the basis for consistently teaching the importance of well-focused dharma practice and wise associations with others actually practicing his dharma. And that directly relates to how we practice here, doesn't it? That's why we don't get into all kinds of other things. We just stay focused on the dharma. And it works pretty well, doesn't it?
Yes.
Siddhartha now understood the subtle but powerful conditioning that follows from ignorance and associating with any dharma that uses fabricated and confused thoughts and feelings as motivation in a common and familiar but distracting focus for practice. That last, again, relates to using a meditation practice to get in touch with our feelings or explore our feelings. That's what this is. That's not what meditation is for. In fact, I would say that if you want to do that, that's fine, but just don't look at it as your jhana practice. Incorporate a third or fourth meditation practice. If that's what you want to do, quiet your mind and start analyzing your feelings, but also understand that there's no benefit to that. Why? Because what are you analyzing? Feelings and thoughts are as impermanent as anything else, any other phenomenon. And so even if you decide you're going to analyze a feeling, that feeling itself is always being fabricated and changing. It's a game of whack-a-mole.
It's ignoring the ignorance.
Yeah, and it's very convenient for that one thing. And that's why so many people are enamored with it. And that, and outside of Dhamma practice, there is some value in analyzing things, particularly in therapy. There's a value to that. And as Bonnie was here, as therapists know, you can take that too far. Good therapists know where to put the brakes on that type of analysis too. In the Buddha's Dhamma, there is no analysis in general. There is introspective insight into these three marks of existence. That's the point. When seen in the context of Siddhartha's brilliant, clear, and direct Dhamma, it is the preoccupation rooted in self-identification with fleeting thoughts and feelings that cannot be resolved through dharmas that encourage validating fabricated thoughts and feelings through distracting, grasping after over-analysis, which is simply just another form of clinging. Grasping after insight through unfocused hybrid meditation methods lacks the framework and guidance of a Buddha's Dhamma and creates a grasping after hope of reconciling feelings and thoughts through fabricated analysis in abstract realities and imaginary non-physical realms. The reason why the Buddha didn't continue that type of teaching so common during his time and today is he understood how cruel it would be to continue that. especially for a person who understands that this is simply more distraction. It would be cruel for him to have continued that. He would have been, he was pretty famous, gathered a lot of followers quickly anyway, but he would have been as instantly famous as other charismatic teachers of his time and our times if he taught what people wanted to learn rather than what they needed to learn. And again, that's a distinguishing difference between what the Buddha taught then and now. And as his Dhamma continues, you can see that people choose to follow different Buddhist teachings rather than the direct teachings of an awakened human being. Is this where I was going to make a break? No. A little bit further tonight, please. The next section is called Insight Begins with Skillful Dhamma Practice. The Buddha taught meditation for one purpose, to increase jhana. Jhana means concentration. Jhana is a quality of mind resting in non-distraction. Another word for that would be samadhi. That's all it means. It means basically the same thing, non-distraction or well-concentrated mind. The Buddha did not teach a standalone or speculative meditation method, hoping for direct insight during that meditation. While useful insight may arise during meditation, lacking the proper framework of the complete Eightfold Path, grasping after insight during meditation simply distracts the meditator from increasing concentration. The Buddha taught meditation as one factor of the Eightfold Path. It is through integrating the complete Eightfold Path that can then support useful and skillful introspective insight. In other words, useful insight needs to be framed by the Eightfold Path, not just direct meditation practice. The Buddha understood that a mind rooted in ignorance requires sustained distraction to continue ignoring ignorance. This is the subtle and debilitating nature of ignorance and of adopting Dharma practices that encourage further ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Seekers since the beginning of recorded history have created often subtle but powerfully debilitating strategies to continue ignorance, including fabricated abstract religions or spiritual practices. And again, I know this sounds like a condemnation of all religions. I'm not trying to do that. I'm just trying to place the perspective between what that is and what this is. Once established by common agreement rather than direct engagement with the Dhamma, an acceptable and comfortable Dharma practice becomes the means for institutionalized ignorance. Contradictory doctrines fabricate paths that cannot provide this fundamental self-developed ability to recognize, interrupt, and abandon ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It is the purpose of the Eightfold Path to develop introspective insight into anicca, anatta, and dukkha, and recognize, interrupt, and abandon ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Most modern meditation practices diminish or dismiss the singular importance of developing jhana in favor of using meditation for reconciling fabricated feelings and thoughts and continued self-establishment in abstract realities and fabricated non-human magical and mystical realms. It is the ongoing distraction of grasping after continued self-establishment and fabricated non-physical realms, and grasping after insight into fleeting, distracting, and meaningless feelings and thoughts that maintains ignorance and continues greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. As such, the beginning of a true jhana practice resides in the four foundations of mindfulness, as taught in the Satipatthana Sutta, and many others. After 6 years of grasping after frustrating and unsuccessful dharmas, and severely weakened from the extreme ascetic practices Siddhartha believed would liberate him, he used jhana, meaning jhana meditation, to deepen his concentration. This simple meditation method developed the internal poise and non-grasping focus necessary to recognize the debilitating confusion and ongoing distraction caused by his own fabricated views. The concentration developed through jhana meditation supports the refined mindfulness necessary to integrate the Eightfold Path as the framework for Dhamma practice. The very foundation of refined mindfulness, right mindfulness, the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, rests and resides in jhana. It is a well-concentrated mind that is able to recognize the conditioned in ignorance distraction of preoccupation with feelings and thoughts arising from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. In other words, our feelings and thoughts are already what distract us. why would we create a practice that encourages further distraction by analyzing them? Do you see the difference there between what the Buddha taught and recognized and what most modern practices do, not just in Buddhist practice? We place such, we're so enamored with our feelings and thoughts because we're attached to them that we can't let go of them unless we have a framework for doing it and a reason to do it. We have to understand why we're going through this process, don't we? And it's very simple to end ignorance and develop wisdom.
John, it's really a relief to know that when you meditate, all you have to do is go back to the breath. And you have no responsibility to memorize the Dhamma or contemplate a feeling or anything. It's really just sitting, following your breath, and that's it.
That's it. Thank you. That is it. And if we look at meditation, if we look at the Buddha's meditation, our meditation, in any other way, we're lost. We can only increase ignorance because it won't increase concentration. It's just that way. And so again, the Buddha taught this simple and complete path. All we have to do is follow direction. And they're pretty simple direction, isn't it? At least I hope they are. I hope I present it as simple as possible. Grasping after fabricated abstractions and calling that Dharma practice can only continue ignorance, and we see that now. The Buddha described his awakening through skillful introspective insight in the Nagara Sutta. And that what we're going to study, all of these sutras are included that I'm mentioning here in our study. Siddhartha described his conditioned thinking as a mental feedback loop of unrestrained thinking, continually influenced by clinging to self-referential fabricated views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Siddhartha realized that his mind had been conditioned by his upbringing, his entanglements with the world, and most significantly, by his grasping after false dharmas. Siddhartha described this understanding as a breakthrough of understanding. He states in the Nagara Sutta, this consciousness turns back at name and form. Name and form is simply putting a name to this form, meaning this is me. Turning back at name and form and goes no further. He's describing being stuck in this feedback loop. It is to this extent that there is birth, aging, death, fading away, and returning. This is where ignorance is established, in that confused feedback loop, in our own minds. From name and form, from identification with impermanent phenomena, from name and form as a requisite condition, from name and form, from identification, from adding more to these six properties than we are, as soon as we do that, we have just established a requisite condition that arises in consciousness, and from consciousness as a requisite condition arises name and form. It's a little bit confusing, but because our thinking is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, we create this feedback loop through attachment to fabricated views that then provide the constraint for our thinking. In other words, our thinking can't go past that self-identification.
The bubble.
And so we've created this fabricated bubble that we live in. And it seems all expansive. It seems like it includes the whole universe. The only thing that it can possibly include is this very limited and very conditioned fabricated view of ourself in relation to the world.
Confirmation bias.
Yes. And so that's why people that truly find liberation through this practice describe, and other people do it in their meditation practice, they call it, it feels spacious. Because it truly is. We finally freed ourselves from that awful, debilitating bubble of our own creation. A bubble of ignorance. Frank?
I'm going to be heading out.
Okay. Well, I'll have this posted later. You can listen to the rest of it. And the second talk I'll be posting on Saturday, though.
Okay.
I'm glad you guys joined. Joe, great to meet you. If you want to follow this up, you can go to my, well, I'll tell you about the website.
Thank you. And, perfect. Thank you.
Great to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
See you guys. Have a safe ride home.
Bye, Eric.
Bye, Catherine.
So long.
Stay calm.
Let me just go back one. From name and form as a requisite condition arises consciousness, and from consciousness as requisite condition arises name and form. Just describing. It sounds contradictory, but it's just describing that feedback loop. The Buddha understood clearly that liberation from a mind caught in a mental feedback loop of fabricated views of self, clinging tenaciously to self-identification with impermanent phenomena, required a path of practice that directly developed specific and well-focused introspective insight into the self-created process. And so that self-created process is the three marks of existence. It's clung together. As stated previously, the Buddha taught an eightfold path that develops introspective insight into these three marks. Siddhartha's experience with the common Dharma practices of his time brought the realization that grasping after abstract fabricated views could only continue the trance-like mental state required by dharmas that encouraging ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So, and just briefly to get into that trance-like state. Trance-like state is not just a created conditioned view where you don't think you're having any thoughts. It's possible to do that. I mean, I could do that with all of you in just a few minutes. I could give you, through suggestion, I could have you sitting in a blank state. And many people think that's the purpose of meditation, to end all your thoughts, at least for a few moments. There's no concentration in a blank light state, is there? There can't be. You're not concentrating on anything. You're mocus. But also, a trance-like state is any establishment, self-establishment, magical, mystical establishment, speculated establishment in a non-physical realm. Anything. That's still a trance-like state. So chasing after a realm of nothingness or unlimited consciousness or anything else is grasping after a trance-like state. But even something as living in a fabricated view of yourself, a mundane fabricated view, is still a trance-like state. It takes, another word for trance is a mind of mental ignorance, isn't it? A mind that's in a trance, that is not aware of thought, is completely ignorant in that moment. So it's the ongoing manifestation of that type of trance-like state in all of those speculated experiences. It's all a trance-like state. As taught in an authentic translation of dependent origination, it is precisely ignorance of Four Noble Truths as a requisite condition for fabricated views of self clinging to all impermanent phenomena that can only lead to greed, aversion, and ongoing deluded thinking. Ignorance is compulsively maintained by adaptation, accommodation, embellishment, or outright dismissal of dependent origination. This compulsion for continued ignorance is made necessary by the need for establishing fabricated salvific dharmas that ultimately hope to resolve in some variant of a non-dual, non-physical self-establishment or another trance-like state. Siddhartha's understanding of the primary need for using meditation solely for increasing jhana was and is a direct counter to a mind conditioned towards ignoring its own ignorance by grasping after and clinging to distracting abstract practices and behaviors. Is that last long sentence clear? I mean, that's really the purpose, so we don't get into that. Yes?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
This includes modern insight practices that encourage grasping after insight and fleeting, insubstantial, meaningless, and distracting feelings and thoughts without the framework and guidance of the Eightfold Path. This type of grasping after meditation practice can only lead to, at best, a familiar and comfortable trance-like quality of mind with no possibility for useful and skillful introspective insight into three marks of existence. Prior to developing right meditation, Siddhartha's mind was prone to distraction from the unrestrained continuous flow of mundane feelings and thoughts. Siddhartha realized that his distracted mind resulted from clinging his self-referential views to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas through self-referential fabricated views. In short, he realized that clinging to the fabricated thoughts, feelings, and magical and mental realms he created had the debilitating effect of defining his self and his life experiences based on those self-created fabrications. Is that clear? So we can create all the imaginary existences that we want, and if somebody says, if somebody that we are following says, that's what your culmination is, we will develop it and we'll create a familiar relationship with it, and now we're simply stuck in another fabrication. And often it makes us feel good because we're doing something. I remember, I won't mention the facility, but I spent many, for once a month I used to go to a certain facility, and I'd meditate with this large group, about 150 people, and a lot of monks and nuns were there, that were very well focused and sincere practice, and I always left there feeling wonderful. We had a meditation, we had a teaching, I wouldn't call it a Dhamma teaching, and we had a meal together, and it was wonderful, and I left there feeling wonderful. But I didn't learn anything of any value. Certainly no insight into the three marks. It was a wonderful social engagement, but that's all it was. I had the illusion that I was actually doing something. I was actually developing a Buddha's Dhamma. I wasn't. Again, it was a pleasant experience. If I didn't have the understanding I have now, I'd probably still be doing it. And still feeling good about it. Pardon me?
Is it an illusion or just losing sight of
Well, it was like an illusion because it was presented that this, I believed I was doing something that a Buddha taught. And it wasn't until I was able to leave that familiar and comfortable surroundings and look at what I was doing that I realized it wasn't. Again, they're wonderful people. One of my, he's passed now, one of my best friends in the Dharma was from, you know, it was his place. So there was a lot of associations with that. And it wasn't until I cut the tie, like the Buddha did, that I was able to see what was occurring. And I'm only saying that because often we'll use something that feels good as justification to continue it. The most common general fabrication within Buddhism is fabricating a hybridized Dharma practice from the confusing and contradictory array of modern Buddhist practices and New Age non-dual doctrines that only encourage the modern phenomena of Buddhism by common agreement. Among seekers of his, this was common during his time and continuing today. Siddhartha initially believed that liberation would be found in salvific religions or salvific philosophical belief systems that combine blind faith, vivid unrestrained imagination, unfounded conjecture and speculation, and unrestrained and unfocused insight. This type of grasping after Dharma practice can only result in continued fabricated views that conveniently provide a subtle and commonly acceptable means of continuing ignorance of Four Noble Truths. In simpler terms, I hope, Siddhartha understood that everything he studied, mastered, and dismissed up until his awakening only served to further distract his mind while obscuring his own ignorance. Siddhartha realized that this debilitating ignorance is self-perpetuated. He understood, another way of saying that is simply we're conditioned to keep our own ignorance. He understood that when a mind is stuck in the feedback loop of confused thinking, compulsively creating clinging associations with impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas, any new experience will always be adapted, accommodated, and or embellished to fit and continue the self-referential views established in ignorance. That another long sentence, is that clear though what that is? That's describing simply how we continue to condition and fabricate things. If our minds are already fabricated and we have no framework for understanding that and recognizing how it's manifesting moment by moment, the only thing we can do with what's occurring is to further fabricate our experience with it. Clear?
Consciousness.
Yeah, we simply don't have the reference point without the Eightfold Path to know what we're doing to ourselves. And it's to ourselves. Again, this is not being done to us by some awful system or even the world. It's just a consequence of living in the world. There's nothing personal about it. And honestly, there's nothing personal about awakening. In other words, we don't become better people because we decide to practice the Dhamma. The only thing I would say about that is we become authentic human beings, which for me is good enough. I'll take it.
It should be easier to live with.
Yeah, it is. Well, if there's, you know, it's gotten like, so events, it's interesting how this happened. So events occurred over the last 4 days that were such a good example of impermanence, and I will talk about it at some point. Not tonight, simply because I don't want it to get too late. Okay. Siddhartha realized that ignorance of Four Noble Truths and the conditioned views that follow must be directly recognized and abandoned. The Buddha's entire Dhamma is developed through fidelity to the Fourth Noble Truth, the truth of the path leading to the cessation of ignorance. Rather than encouraging an insight-focused meditation with no framework and guidance, the Buddha taught a simple and direct Eightfold Path that develops specific insight into the relationship of self-referential views clinging to impermanent phenomena. We're almost done, folks. Jhana meditation is for increasing concentration. It is a well-concentrated mind that is able to develop the refined mindfulness necessary to integrate, to hold in mind, the entire path as the means for establishing an initial right view for beginning Dhamma practice. It rests in a concentration practice, not in abstract ideas. For beginning Dhamma practice, that culminates in a profound right view of an arahant, another human being awakened through the Buddha's Eightfold Path. It is the Eightfold Path that provides the framework and guidance necessary to recognize the bondage to ignorance that is obscured by conditioned thinking. It's the purpose of conditioned thinking. By conditioned thinking distracted by self-identification with impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas. That last line that I keep repeating, objects, events, views, and ideas, that is our interaction in relationship to the world. It's through one of those four things, or all of those four things. Objects, events, views, and ideas. Right? Any Dharma practice that diminishes in importance or dismisses outright jhana meditation and the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path cannot be seen as a Dhamma practice taught by the Buddha. That's the end of part one. I know there's an awful lot of information, and again, those of you that have been, these teachings and these individual sessions are not to be grasped after either, and that you have to understand everything that was said. You understand that that's part of Dhamma practice. So this and Saturday's class lays the broad framework of what we're going to be discussing over the next 32 classes. And so, if you feel like you missed something here, don't worry about it. You're going to get it. I just wanted to lay this broad framework so we understand where we're going. And again, I'll conclude it with Saturday. And again, just to emphasize it, please attend as many classes as you can, and the ones you can't, try to pick them up through the recordings. Let's go around the room and see how you're doing. But a few people have joined. Oh, Mara's joined. And Jane is here. There's three things up there. So, Jane, what do you think of tonight's sutta? Or talk, it's not a sutta.
Oh, you covered quite a lot tonight, John.
Yeah, is he?
A year ago, I would not have been able to follow along.
Yeah.
But I believe through my meditation practice and, your skillful teaching and just the strength of the teachings themselves, I mean, it makes perfect. I was able to follow along. It makes perfect sense. And not only that, but it's been life-changing. So yeah. What a difference.
Yeah, what a great way to put it. I would say that too, life-changing. Thank you. Maura, how are you? Hello, Maura.
Hi, John.
There you are. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Excellent talk. I don't feel that I have anything to add. I think it was clear and on point, and I appreciated it.
Good. I'm glad you joined us tonight.
Likewise.
It's 8:40. We have time to go around the room, right? We can. Everybody's okay. Oh, we usually stay till 9 anyway. Everybody's okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good evening, Jen.
Good evening. I just echo the sentiment of what people have already said. I don't really have anything to add. It was very clear. I was able to follow along. Thank you.
You're welcome. Do you feel like I've given you a broad enough background to understand where we're going?
Yes.
And you all do?
Yeah.
I feel
okay,
like
that was the point.
The groundwork has been laid.
Thank you. And the reason why that's important, it should be important to all of us, but I'm pretty sure this is going to be one of my next books, and I think it might even be an established online teaching that I'll be able to establish. So I think it's going to be important. So. Good evening, Matt.
Good evening, John. Good evening, everyone. Good to see everybody. I don't have a lot to add, although I really like the way that you started this study and framed it in Vipassa. So, looking at that, and it was very clear that the insight that we're gaining through this practice is the insight into the three marks. So,
great. Thank you, sir. That's what I was hoping to develop when I did it. Thanks. Good evening, Lorna.
Evening. I'll sit to Noble-san.
Glad you're here. Hello, Tim.
Good evening, everybody. I'm going to sit in Noble-san as well.
Glad you're here. Good evening, Ron.
Good evening, John. Yeah, when I was reading this part of the introduction earlier, I had to get out my pen and pencil and start diagramming it out because I've been waiting for this series of lectures for a while.
A couple months.
Yeah, because I know that this is where. Still quite a bit of my confusion rests or lack of insight.
The point, though.
Yeah. And it's starting to click. I know there's a way to go, but it's starting to click. I'm starting to keep that whole ball of yarn, which I know what it looks like to me at this point. These strange interrelationships between, you know, the three marks and how they feed back to each other, and how one, you know, makes the other harder to deal with. But I'm happy in the knowledge that we're on the way to start teasing this apart and getting some real insight.
Yeah. Thank you, and we're going to do that. Again, just to emphasize, don't be too concerned that you got everything out of tonight's talk, because that's what the rest of the classes are for, to flesh this all out. I've said enough. Kate, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. I don't have anything to add either, so.
I'm glad you're here. Hello, Helen.
Hello, John. I think I've made my contributions for the evening.
Thank you for that. Mary, good to see you.
Good to see you. I'm glad we finally arrived at this. There's always more to learn and build on or to readdress areas that you are blocked or you're still clinging. So it's wonderful to have this foundation laid out, and I look forward to the education. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, David.
Yeah, I'm good tonight.
Glad you're here. Hello, Liz.
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
Good. I'm just glad I've had 4 years of an introduction so that I could understand everything you said to me.
We all got our bachelors at Translake State.
Thank you. As I was putting this, I could not have taught this. I would not have taught. I could have. I wouldn't have taught it 2 years ago, maybe even a year ago, mm-hmm. simply because you've all developed to the point where you do understand these references. And you do understand, at least, it may be a little bit abstract right now, but that's the point of the next 32 classes. Where I sit, where each and every one of us sits, this is where the Dhamma is resolved. It's in understanding that my views of myself were not a self, but now I've developed realistic views of what I am. That's everything. That's the Dhamma. It resolves here. It resolves in a mind united in its body. And this is the insight is the way of drilling down to that you could call it the one single point of understanding. And it is the complete opposite of no self or annihilation. You could call it the true birth of a self in the world. And that's not an overstatement. At least I don't think it is. Kevin, good to see you.
Nice to see you, John. Thank you. Nice to see everybody else, too. We really appreciate you laying this out as you have, and your diligence that you put forth in this. I also really liked how you gave a review of what the Buddha awakened to, and how he sort of turned away from external influences and focused inwardly. Yeah. And that's a really significant thing to emphasize, and how you also said all the associations and all those things need to be looked at. And you did a very skillful job and made it easy to grasp and not too overwhelming. So I'm looking forward to sticking to this, and thank you for laying it out and providing the accountability and Sangha support. So.
Thank you for your kind words. It really was as excited as this meditator can get. I've been excited about starting to teach this. Russ, good to see you.
John, I have nothing to add, but I'm glad I was here.
I'm glad you were here, too. again, I won't go on too long. It's gotten late. The other thing, and I emphasize this always, over and over again, we're going to be covering a lot. And calling it a structured study, I even thought, well, should I do that? Because it might. Even though it's a structured study, the point of that, calling it a structured study, is kind of a counter to the unstructured way that insight is often presented. So we're engaged in a very specific structured way of looking at this. But as always, we'll go through this, we'll develop it in a very gentle way. There's nothing to grasp after in the Buddha's Dhamma. It all comes to us by simply engaging in gentle right effort, and that's what we're going to do. There's something else I was going to say, but I think that's it. Any other questions or comments? You all notice in the email that included in the email that I sent out is also a link to the overall schedule. Mm-hmm. So if you want to, you can always look at where we're going. But every week, I'll always include whatever sutta we're going to be addressing in that link too. All right, let's finish. Pardon me?
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
Incredible amount of work, John. Thank you.
You're welcome. And now that you're saying. I greatly do appreciate it, and it's important for me. I don't need the praise, but I need to know that I'm actually doing something that's worthwhile.
Getting through. And
yeah, that is. That's important to me. Because to my way of thinking, if I'm sitting here contributing to your further ignorance, then I'm being cruel, and I don't want to be cruel. That's enough. I think it's enough. I could probably keep talking.
Not probably.
Professor Emeritus.
You're being cool.
Fresh boy over there.
I'm looking for. We'll finish with meta as we always do.
I'll wear my pajamas next. I can go right to
wait.
Bed.
Wait till retreat.
We should all get a fuzzy slipper.
I gotta say, I never noticed it before, but I notice it here. This is the most comfortable sangha I've ever been part of. It really is. And there was always an underlying tension. I mentioned this other place that I used to go to, and some other. I mean, it wasn't even really all that noticeable, but because there was no real focus, there was this underlying social tension in the room. I think it's not here. I don't feel it or see it at all.
Well, there's no real hierarchy.
Yeah, there isn't. And that's why our retreats are the way they are, but that's how the Buddha's Dhamma was. When you read the suttas, he wasn't sitting up on a high chair. In fact, he talked people against doing that. He was just another human being that figured it out and told people to wake up. Okay, find your relaxed meditation posture again and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. These are the Buddha's words in metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness, excuse me, and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Thank you all for joining online, Jane and Moore. Peace.
Thank you, John. Have a good week.
You too.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye, Maura.
Bye, Maura.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.